Welcome to This Green Earth. I'm Seth Arns.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
Today we are talking with environmental scientist and author Dr. Shahir Masri. Dr. Masri recently set aside his work at the University of California, Irvine as an air pollution researcher to talk with people on the front lines of climate change from across the United States. Dr. Masri's recent book, On the Road for Climate Action, A Story of Science Activism and American Adventure, weaves environmental data with stories about climate change and human and community resilience in the face of both climate change and ecological disaster. Welcome to This Green Earth, Dr. Masri.
Thank you for having me.
I was wondering if we could start off with just telling us a little bit about both your background and then what inspired you to kind of step away from your traditional work as a scientist and get out on the road and talk with people about climate change and how it's impacting them.
Yeah, sure. So my background going way back is a person who's always loved the outdoors, appreciated hiking and enjoyed surfing and being out in the snow and rock climbing and all that. So I've got sort of this, I guess, nature related background, recreational background. But my mother's also an environmental science teacher, or was throughout most of my life, and a biology teacher. So I also had this sort of science, I guess, influence through her. And as I came to pursue my own degree in college, it was really the intersection of science and nature and the environment that I wanted to find an area of study. And environmental science was that area of study. More specifically, I focus on environmental health, which is really air pollution, water pollution, and sort of environmental exposures that lead to human health impacts that I came to focus more on. In graduate school, those departments tend to be housed under schools of public health. So through my graduate training, I was at the School of Public Health at Harvard, where I pursued my master and then subsequently my doctoral degree with a focus on environmental exposure assessment. Now, it's virtually impossible to study environmental exposure assessment and air pollution specifically without the giant cloud of climate change sort of just looming over the entire field. Public health in particular, if we care about a whole variety of different areas of public health, climate change really is one of those really umbrella issues that impact so many different sub-issues, whether it's refugee crisis, whether it's infectious disease, climate destruction, air pollution, water quality. Climate change touches on all those things. And so to me, that was just a really pressing issue that I needed to focus on in my work, whether strictly through my academic publishing or just kind of getting out on the road and bridging sort of science with community members. And that's ultimately what gave rise to the 2018 On the Road for Climate Action project that I launched with my then girlfriend, now wife, Athena. And again, it really was having come out of grad school, starting to publish studies, seeing that there was really a lot of research already out there. I was contributing, you know, in the air pollution field, but there seemed to be a real gap between what scientists understood and what the public understood. And that's unfortunately not just pure happenstance. There's a lot of politicization and targeted smearing of science to sort of create this confusion among the public. And I wanted to really contribute to improving the understanding of the public on this important topic. And so that, again, was the sort of foundation for this grassroots project, On the Road for Climate Action, which ultimately led to my book, On the Road for Climate Action.
It's interesting how we communicate the climate crisis and different ways in which we can connect with people. And you really went on what you describe as an American adventure and talked to people and did the front lines with different groups of communities and individuals. How did that interaction with people inform you how to communicate better about climate sciences and have a broader audience?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I had actually this sort of change of, through my project, the way I would communicate with people about climate change. And interestingly, I sort of, as an academic lecturer, type of person, went on the road, and somebody who's passionate about science, we did tons of town halls and presentations to the public. But one thing I hadn't fully appreciated was just how much I was going to learn from community members across the country, firsthand observations. And to your question, I really shifted a lot of how I communicate science and the issue of climate change to the public by, pie charts and graphs and sharing that kind of data-driven type of presentation, shifting that into a bit more of a storytelling presentation. And I think the way that I hope this book helps to inform the public and serve as both an interesting read, but also a tool for climate communication, is by filling a gap that we have, you know, with all this data and these climate reports, a gap that really brings to light the stories of how climate change is impacting communities across the country from a real personal perspective. Rivers expanding and swallowing homes, you know, erosion from massive flooding events leading to foundations being undermined. Like, we interviewed residents in Ohio, houses literally collapsing under eroding foundations, washed away. Residents of hurricanes, in the case of the people we interviewed in Texas who experienced Hurricane Harvey, having their cars totally wiped away. Since they weren't recoverable, they couldn't prove to insurance that they had been damaged. So a lot of people, you know, following some of these hurricanes, were completely left just helpless without any kind of financial compensation for the property they lost. So a lot of those stories we encountered, which I talk about in the book, I think are helpful aids to people to help understand what is actually happening at a more personal level to people across the country, how people's lives are being affected by climate change, destabilization of the climate, extreme weather, and so on.
It's one thing to bring together and collate some of these ecological, environmental disasters, natural hazards, Hurricane Harvey, floods, and relate that to changes in climate. I think many of us have pretty good awareness of that. One thing I want to explore a little bit with this work is it seems to me like you've really tried to take a bit of a positive spin on this. Not that any of these changes are positive, but how are people and communities responding to these disasters? Did you see stories of building greater resilience in the aftermath of some of these ecological crises?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's something, again, that was a bit unforeseen as we launched the project, you know, thinking about talking about climate impacts from a, you know, negative disaster sort of background to seeing what communities are doing. That was a bit of just an organic discovery throughout the project, and one that as I was writing this book, felt very compelled to share. And with each chapter, there's sort of this natural transition into the positive things people are doing. And it really was inspiring for me to see. So to kind of touch on some of those in areas like Florida, that are succumbing to extreme flooding events and rainfall. One of the community's members that I interviewed, she's terraced her land to absorb the water so that it's not, you know, just completely washing down river and flooding other people's homes. Those kinds of things, if adopted on a wider scale, which she's helping inspire others, can translate to meaningful impacts in the community there. I interviewed people who have created environmental justice groups, which are helping to educate people about climate change, helping to get people out there to vote and to reject, you know, candidates, for instance, who are climate denialist candidates, and help support those who are really have a blueprint for action. We've interviewed people from universities and campuses around the country where, in one case in Pennsylvania, a coal plant was closed recently. And instead, there's a geothermal plant. This was actually a coal plant that was not a conventional coal plant to generate electricity, but actually to heat water to keep the campus warm during the, you know, pits of winter. Instead, they've got a geothermal plant now, which drills down 500 feet beneath the soil and actually serves as both an air conditioning and a geothermal warming unit for the campus. So in the winter, they're no longer burning coal, which was the leading polluter actually in that community, was that one coal plant. So another inspiring example, there's other universities that are adopting solar in their parking structures to help charge EVs and also power the campus. In fact, we see that probably firsthand across high schools and other things across the country as well. Farmers, same thing. We interviewed some really progressive minded farmers who are using the land in ways that help actually create biodiversity and help butterflies, which are succumbing to massive environmental degradation, the monarch butterfly being a hallmark example, as we see these massive agriculture monocrop projects that really just decimate biodiversity and habitat. And so in every place we went, we really saw these points of inspiration where communities are doing things at the grassroots ground level to impact their own local level. And we didn't visit every community in the country, but in extrapolating, you really could see how the story of climate action really isn't just one written by the Al Gore's, Bill McKibben's, and Greta's of the world, who are doing fantastic and important work, but really by the individuals across the country whose names we'll never know and never see written into headlines. And so that was really an inspiring part of this project, which I was felt important to share through my book.
So even the origins of writing this book, when you set out to make these discoveries, were you already calculating that you were going to congregate all of this information that you were gathering and structure a book for people to gain a greater understanding? How did the structure of this book come about, and were you already writing it along the way, or did this come after your big journey?
So, interesting question. It was not even in the most remote corners of my mind writing a book. In fact, I simply set out to try to evoke change on the ground. And I figured when this project's over, the project's over. One thing I did envision, which ultimately helped me to write this book, in fact, it was extremely important. I envisioned sharing videos. So we did a lot of filming of our interviews. I envisioned that being more of a social media YouTube project, and I did share a fair amount of content on YouTube, but ultimately that's not what most of the footage ended up being useful for. As time went on, I thought about the importance of this journey and that I could bring it together in a book, and ultimately was able to turn to so much of the footage. And there was so much that it almost felt like almost impossible to edit and publish all this stuff. Little did I know writing a book would be just as daunting a task, if not more, but ultimately that was sort of, I had a lot of this footage that was sort of sitting around. It wasn't making it online because of, full-time job and all that. And I took a stab at writing a couple chapters, as you do when you're going to pitch a book to agents and publishers. And that's when I really, realized that this really could make a compelling book, and it could live in a more permanent space and perhaps be shared in a more important and meaningful way that would last longer over time. But that footage was just instrumental in writing this book, because there's no way I could have just remembered all those things. And there's another thing I should mention. So I did envision potentially some sort of study, because I'm an academic. So I created a survey that I would disseminate to communities across the country and people across the country to gain some understanding of climate change sentiment. And that was ultimately published as a peer-reviewed paper. And because of that study, I did take a lot of notes during our actual presentations and meetings and town halls when people were speaking and sharing about their experiences and observations with respect to extreme weather and climate change. I had written a lot of that stuff down because of this peer-reviewed paper that I was hoping to publish. And so ultimately those notes and all that footage was so important in bringing together this book.
Yeah, it seems like so much information to gather and to disseminate, and then just at the root of what you're trying to do, bring it to a broader audience so we can all understand this a little bit better. But when you're thinking back to this journey that you went on, in your mind's eye, what's the first thing that really comes up to you? What's that visual or that story that really still grips you or stays with you?
Something that comes to mind was an interview with a farmer in Minnesota that we interviewed that was talking about the impacts of extreme rainfall. It's one thing to, I think, hear headlines, but in interviewing this farmer, I learned just how dramatic the rainfall events are and how they impact the livelihoods of farmers. And these are the people that are, we're relying on for our own food and production. So in some ways, these are heroes within our community. He described 17-inch rain event in a single 24-hour period. And I asked him what that was like. And it was trees washing down the roads, hillsides collapsing. This was a rather hilly part of farm country, which isn't so typical necessarily. And a farmer that was a bit lower on the hillside had his entire potato field inundated with floodwaters. They were uncovered. They became contaminated. Floodwaters are a mix of so many things that you don't want touching your food crops, which forced him to have to abandon his entire potato crop that year. So he had a Whole Foods contract, actually, which he wasn't able to meet. And so that was just one story that comes to mind of just how devastating these extreme weather events can be for individuals whose livelihoods are dependent on stable weather. Many of us are fortunate in the city to have jobs that are not so tied to weather in such a direct way, but that's not the case for farmers across the country. And another example is just how many farms across the country, unlike California, where I'm from. And this was another farmer who I interviewed who was talking about this in South Dakota. These farmers are not using sprinkler systems, but are actually dependent on regular rainfall for their crops. And one of the farmers we interviewed at Johnson Farms, also featured in the book, talked about now in recent years seeing really concentrated rain patterns, which are followed by potentially up to 2-3 weeks of no rain at all. And that's just really not the way that plants grow successfully and crops grow. And so just another example within our sort of farm segment of our tour, just how dramatic these impacts can be and ultimately do affect us at the grocery store as well in terms of prices.
The science about climate change is pretty clear. We see tangible changes happening across the landscapes of the United States. However, people's beliefs about climate change, understanding of climate change, opinions about climate change are pretty varied, much more varied than the scientific consensus is on that. What was your experience with just approaching people randomly or farmers randomly and talking about climate change? What was your experience with how people viewed climate change?
So we did experience both ends of the spectrum in terms of a couple of guys we asked, if they'd complete our climate related survey. They were sitting at, I think it was a gas station. And the second they heard climate change, they sort of mocked the idea of a climate hoax and didn't want to participate in the survey. So we did experience some of that. In our own presentations, there was very little of that. And, admittedly, there is somewhat of a self-selection process when you're giving a climate change talk. You're probably not going to get as many folks who are not interested in climate change or think it's a hoax, and instead get a lot of people who do care about climate change. However, and so that was the case throughout many of our talks, but there were some talks, for instance, Shadron, Nebraska. The host put us on warnings, so to speak, that this was a very contentious topic in the community, that the scientists, teachers in that community did not even believe in climate change. And so I was prepared a bit more for a contentious talk with pushback. Interestingly, it turned out to be one of our most attended talks. And there was a noticeable, through the Q&A period, sentiment of skepticism, but that didn't translate to personal attacks or rudeness, no tomato tossing or anything of that nature. Instead, translated to a lively discussion, and people did seem receptive. They asked questions that showcased that they weren't totally in belief of this, but the questions were articulated and important, and I was able to address them from a scientific perspective, and they seemed to be well received. And a lot of our climate-related material at our booth was picked up. Everybody was really polite. I had a very positive experience there, despite being prepared for the worst, and that was reassuring. I think that it should be noted that while there is a lot of variability about people's perspectives on this topic, research and polling over the years has showed that the climate denial community is really a very small minority of public opinions. It's about 10% or even lower. And despite that, we've still been led to believe there's this big climate divide in the country. And admittedly, a lot of that minority is very loud speaking, in some cases, media entities really peddling that kind of information. But it's very overrepresented, I think, in the media. Less so nowadays, but still overrepresented. It's by no means a 50-50 split. It's more of a, I would say, like a 70-10 split, with 10 or 20% in the middle who are somewhere in between.
Well, I like that you had this very engaging dialogue. That is so important when we're discussing things that we don't agree on, keeping that discourse and having that engaging dialogue. So it's encouraging to hear that. I also want to tap into another chapter of your book that talks about sacred lands and climate change and the indigenous experience. Can you walk us through a little bit of your experience while you were talking to tribal nations and their thoughts on climate change and how they're navigating it?
I can't speak for all communities, of course, but the ones that we spoke with, our experience was that climate change is no surprise that indigenous communities have sort of long been aware of the fragility of the environment and the human role, the human impacts that society can play in leading to deterioration. And they know that firsthand. most certainly, and are very much in touch with the environment still. There were some inspiring things that we observed. I'm thinking specifically about the Pine Ridge Reservation that we visited in South Dakota, where there was a community project essentially that was building climate resilient homes for indigenous people, constructing them through using indigenous labor, which is distinct from a lot of the experience of indigenous communities where federal dollars might come in once a year, bring in food, bring in a sort of economy that dissipates as soon as those dollars are spent. It's sort of like an input, but not a sustainable economy within tribal nation. And so this was an example of a community building resiliency for climate change, offering affordable housing for indigenous residents. Like I said, employing indigenous to construct these. These had solar panels. They were built to withstand over 80 mile per hour winds. They had a regenerative agriculture system on the land. They were growing their own food, which is again distinct from the sort of just bringing food onto the reservation and then it disappears after dollars are gone. And so that was really inspiring to see. We did find, however, that, you know, there's still a fair amount of trepidation and hesitation with, you know, when approaching indigenous communities, because they've seen a lot of people come and go. They've seen, as we were told, a lot of false promises from outsiders, you know, wanting to help. Approaching indigenous communities has to be done, I think, with that in mind and with an intent to listen, not just teach or anything like that, and to offer a genuine help and not just, you know, sort of benefit yourself or benefit your project. As I did research for the book, a lot of the chapter that I have written on the indigenous section of our book was the research that accompanied, you know, touching down in those communities. And as I uncovered a lot about those communities we visited after visiting them and learning more about them, and you learn just how cheated these individuals have been, whether it's those who saw the Black Hills get absorbed by South Dakota, the state, despite promises that would be to the native people. And so there's a lot of understandable trepidation and, you know, disbelief of people's word when they engage with indigenous communities. And of course, there's a much greater history of colonization that accompanied the whole Western expansion into the United States. But at the local level, there's stories of broken treaties that are still very fresh in the minds of Native Americans.
Based on your travels, your experience writing this book, what can both the average person and other scientists and people specifically caring about climate change do about climate action? This being the title of your book, Thinking About Climate Action.
So I think that civic duty is just incredibly important and can't be underestimated or understated. I often talk about three pillars of climate action. I place civic duty at the top because we've been talking about carbon footprint and personal actions we can take to green our own homes or lives. But I think we're talking about an issue that is so great that we need top-down change and we need it quickly. And that's only going to come about not through a populist movement of philanthropic actions and changed lives and reduced consumption, which again, we've been talking about for decades, but really through electing candidates to lead our country who understand climate change, who are not echoing the words of corporate beneficiaries of the business as usual fossil fuel driven energy model, but instead are understanding of the science of climate change. They have a blueprint for climate action. That's incredibly important. So, whether it's a city level or the state level or the federal level, elected officials at all levels need to be paid attention to. And we need to put the people in office who are acknowledging this issue and have a blueprint for actually taking charge and leading on this issue.
If people wanted to pick up your book, On the Road for Climate Action, A Story of Science, Activism, and an American Adventure, where would they go and how do they learn more about you?
So you can pre-order now at westwoodpress.com. And I have my own website where you can learn a lot more about me. It's shahirmosri.com.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Shahir Mosri, for being a part of This Green Earth today.
Thank you both. Much appreciated.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth.
If you have an idea, we'd love to hear from you. Give us your ideas and topics, your storylines. It's thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
You can also find us wherever you listen to your podcast.
If you like the show and you learn something new, make sure you leave a review. And we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.